I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The tradition of honor within American politics seems to be coming to a close, at least according to Sheldon Whitehouse. From his perch in the U.S. Senate, he calls corporations an unseen ruling class in our political system, and he's calling on us to reclaim our government. He'll tell us how. Then we enter the world of sci-fi, comic books, and all things nerdy. Our guides, the Marvel writer who brought us the female Thor, and the special effects artist behind visuals you've seen in Star Trek and Breaking Bad. We'll find out how they got into the storytelling biz and why they call Kansas City home. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Sheldon Whitehouse has seen government from all kinds of vantage points as a prosecutor, regulator, staffer, candidate, and now as a U.S. senator from Rhode Island. And Whitehouse has some news for us that may not be all that surprising, but it's very, very concerning. Corporate influence over American politics, he said, has exploded in recent years, and campaign finance laws hardly matter anymore. He writes this, "Never in my life have I seen such a complex web of front groups sowing deliberate deceit to create public confusion about issues that should be clear." That's from his new book, Captured, The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse joins us now from Washington, D.C. And Senator, it's a pleasure to have you. Good morning.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on.
This message that corporate America is dominating our politics won't surprise a whole lot of people, but you know, many of us have suspected this for a while. So why can't you guys change that, Senator?
The biggest reason is probably the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. Hmm. The Citizens United decision, as I think many of your listeners know, was the one that said that everybody's got a right to spend as much money as they want in political races. And, of course, the people who are
including corporations, right? Yeah.
Exactly. It's corporations who tend to be able to take advantage of that the most, A, because they're the bigger they are, the bigger their stockpile of money is,
mm-hmm.
But B, because their interests in Washington tend to be more than any individual person's interests. They have, in many cases, multi-billion dollar interests at stake. So putting hundreds of millions of dollars into politics to defend those interests is a really sweet deal for them. And the result is enormous power shifting to big special interests in the corporate sector. And not all of it is visible. You know, what they said in Citizens United was you can spend all the money you want.
Mm-hmm.
What they omitted was, and because you can spend all the money you want, you can threaten or promise to spend all the money you want. And, of course, threats and promises to that effect are usually going to be secret and private. And that is what we can't measure and don't see.
So when a politician is threatened, maybe even privately, you know, by a private interest group that has behind it millions of dollars to spend in political races, you're suggesting here that those kinds of threats matter and maybe even matter a whole lot.
A whole lot, because they come in potentially politically lethal doses. I chronicled cases in which a false front organization was set up, had $5 million dumped into it. The $5 million was moved immediately into political campaigns. The organization was disestablished, and basically it was a drive-by shooting politically, and nobody was able to unpack who was behind it. But the ability to do something like that necessarily implies the ability to threaten to do that, and that puts everybody on notice. Look out. And
so,
I think it's one of the reasons that people are so frustrated right now. They're not seeing the results that they want out of government, and in large part it's because they have an opponent that they don't really perceive because they do their work so quietly.
So when your constituents and residents of a state like Missouri and Kansas say, hey, you know, we're tired of all this, it needs to change, you point to a Supreme Court ruling and a recent one at that that says, hey, we just can't wave a magic wand out here in the U.S. Senate and change this overnight. You can't do it. That's your point.
Well, there are things that really can be done. And the biggest one would be to pass a law which the Supreme Court allowed in its decision, a law that would require at least that this big unlimited spending be done in the light of day. So these dark money operations in which a big special interest puts potentially hundreds of millions of dollars through an entity like Donors Trust, which is an entity that exists solely for the purpose of laundering the identity off of money, and then it comes out clean of the source from Donors Trust, and then it goes into another organization that then spends it in politics. All of that nonsense would be unwound, and we could do that legislatively.
Why doesn't that happen,
Senator?
You'd
have the problem of unlimited money, and you'd still have the problem of unlimited threats, but you at least wouldn't have all this dark money floating around behind the names of phony organizations.
So why can't you guys change that?
Well, there's some winners and there's some losers from all of this, and the people who are the big winners don't want it to change. One of the reasons I wrote the book was to draw attention to this so that popular pressure could be brought to bear against it. But if you're the fossil fuel industry, if you're the pharmaceutical industry, if you're Wall Street, you actually love this state of affairs because you can exert enormous power over government, in some cases controlling power over government, and have it really hard for anybody to trace your hand in pulling those strings because of all the different cutouts that are used to de-identify the source of the money.
Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is my guest. His new book captured the corporate infiltration of American democracy. You know, President Trump bills himself as a change agent. Is his election, you know, a recognition by the American people that there's a need to do things differently?
Absolutely. And I think that you could say that a great number of the Trump voters and a great number of the Bernie voters, we're all experiencing an enormous amount of frustration that they didn't feel their voice was being heard. And the point of my book is I think they're correct. Their voice was not being heard. And what I worry about is that we misdiagnose the cause and say, well, it's because American democracy is no good, when in fact the cause is that there is a very silent, very powerful encroachment by corporate special interests that is preventing the things that most people want to happen from happening. And then the corporate special interests are only too happy to have the blame fall on government itself because their hand is still obscured. And by the way, government is the big special interest's primary rival for power. So if you can knock down your rival a little bit, that's good too.
Well, Sheldon Whitehouse is making a big deal of this. I'm wondering, why isn't the leadership of your Democratic Party in the Senate, under Chuck Schumer from New York, pushing the same message that it's time to fight back against these big corporations?
We have. We actually pushed last year a very big effort that we badged as the We the People effort to undo Citizens United with a constitutional amendment, to pass the disclosure laws, and to restrict lobbying and access to folks in Congress. And it got no place. Once again, there are people who are very, very big winners, and they love the status quo. It's just the American public that's getting taken for a ride.
Is this a Democrat versus Republican issue, Senator?
It ought not to be.
Right.
And particularly on the dark money side, there's really no upside to allowing big special interests to hide behind screens and fronts and do their mischief without anybody knowing who they are. That's kind of undemocratic and un-American. But it's very unbalanced right now. I had a conversation with a Republican friend on the Senate floor and said, you know, you really ought to back my disclosure bill. This is leading no place good. And he said, yeah, we really should. But you guys need to raise a hell of a lot more dark money, because then it's even and, like, we're happy and we can get rid of the damn stuff. But while we're getting so much more of it than you are, it's crazy to ask us to give up that advantage.
I'm laughing,
so,
and I shouldn't
again,
be.
Again, popular pressure, I think, will make a difference. And people understanding that this is the problem and there are solutions to it, I think, could give us a lot of confidence that things are not as out of control as they seem to be in our government and in our future. We have the ability to make this right, and putting the government back into the hands of people and under the control of human beings is the best way to do that.
Again, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse is my guest. He's the author of Captured, the Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Senator, let's dive into this a little bit more, because you say in your opening to the book that government is no longer of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's pretty strong stuff. Tell us about that, and what are you seeing exactly from the floor of the United States Senate?
Sure. Let me start with a really basic proposition, though, which is that when the country was founded and when the Constitution was written, it was pretty clearly the understanding of America's founding fathers that corporations would have zero role in our government, that our government would be entirely a government of human beings.
And you suggest they missed the boat here a little bit, the founders.
Yeah, I think that they didn't see it coming. It wasn't a present threat to them at the time, and they just didn't set up any safeguards. But I do believe that if you had polled the founding fathers as they put the Constitution together and said, what do you all think the role is of business corporations in this democracy you are building? They would have, to a person, said, none at all, of course. This is a government that is of and by human beings. So that starts us with the proposition that the amount of that the role of corporations in our democracy should be about zero.
And I should point out that, as you point out in the book, Senator, that corporations back in the 1780s and 90s were a very different proposition than the ones we see today.
Yeah, they did things like make canals and roads and schools and, so forth. They weren't the big business behemoths that we see today. And what we see today is lobbying expense, where corporate lobbying exceeds all other lobbying by 30-1, which is pretty dominant ratio. We see intervention by corporations in elections in the multi-hundred-million-dollar expenditures per election. Just one corporate front group spent more than $750 million in the last election. And that same group has pledged to spend $400 million in the 2018 elections. You have administrative agencies that are so overwhelmed by what's called regulatory capture by the industries they're supposed to regulate that there's actually a thing called regulatory capture that economists and administrative law people write about all the time. And you've got, I think, a lot of pressure on our court system to see things through a corporate lens and to diminish the jury, which is the institution that is most designed in our whole constellation of government to push back against private power and influence.
So the entire system has been hijacked, is what you're suggesting here, all the way through the government.
It is pervasive. It is extremely powerful, and it is also stealthy, because no special interest celebrates publicly that they have flipped a senator on an issue to guarantee that he'll go their way. No big industry puts a flag up over a regulatory agency to say, ha, we caught them now. They don't want the public to know the extent of their power, because that limits their power. But it means that a public that isn't paying attention could easily be unaware of the extent to which the problems that we face in government are really an artifact of corporate capture of various institutions of government and not of a defect in government itself. Go back to the same government, just with human beings, and I think so many of our problems disappear.
I'm going to go to some calls in just a moment, Senator, but your comment a few minutes ago about the corporate firepower that's available in terms of the lobbying pressure that gets exerted on lawmakers, how does that affect someone like you? I mean, can you walk down the halls of the Capitol or even in your office building and not be accosted by a lobbyist looking to buttonhole you on one issue or another? Or is your schedule booked up all day long from lobbyists who are demanding to see you? How does it play out in your life?
It plays out not so much with them prowling the halls, grabbing people at random, but with constant meetings and then constantly working not only senators, but also the staff,
right?
Particularly the committee staff, and jumping in quickly when something looks like it might go the wrong way. The lobbying piece, even though it's a 30-to-1 advantage for corporate interests against everybody else, is not the worst piece, though, because, you know, you can ignore what the lobbyists say.
Right.
It's hard to ignore when somebody's going to step up in your election and spend potentially tens of millions of dollars to just beat the tar out of you politically, and they can do so without even letting anybody know who they are.
Hmm. Yeah, it's amazing.
There are plenty of industries that have issues in Washington where the swing for them is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, depending on how policy comes down. So to spend $5 or $10 million to beat the tar out of somebody in an anonymous campaign of negative advertising is chump change. It's, they find that in their couches.
Wow.
And yet to a candidate or to a sitting office holder, it's a very, very significant threat.
Let's go to some phone calls here for Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Let's go to Amy from Johnson County on the Kansas side. Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I just could talk about this for like an hour with this good senator. Thank you very much for coming on and stating the
things you
said. I have a lot of agreements and disagreements, but the main comment I'd like to make is why was the marginalization of Bernie Sanders so prevalent when he's been speaking about this stuff for so long? That's not question number one. Number two, I have a tendency to disagree, and many of us progressives disagree, that the Democrats do it less. We see an awful lot of this stuff going on, and it's become sort of a one-party system when it comes to the money coming from the corporations. Hmm. And there's no delineation anymore, except for some minor social issues or major social issues that are used as wedge issues every time, every 4 years that come about. And I believe that there is a way to get around this until Citizens United can be overturned. And Bernie Sanders proved that with small contributions. He was a viable candidate, a very viable candidate. And that's why the Democratic Party has lost an awful lot of us and why we aren't coming back, because there's no support behind a man who genuinely believed that this is a problem and this can be fixed.
Amy, I appreciate the comments. Senator, let's talk about the marginalization, to use Amy's word, of Bernie Sanders. Has he been, in your mind?
Well, he's been elevated to leadership here in the Senate, and he's certainly a very strong voice, and not just a strong voice himself, but it's now very clear that he speaks for tens of millions of Americans who still support him and still want to have the policies and the principles that he stands for further stood up for in our government. He was not our candidate, obviously, and so he was marginalized to that degree. But he's far more significant and consequential than a great many other senators because of that backing and because of that experience. And I think the Bernie phenomenon also proved, as Amy said, that there is a path to having real political success in this country that does not require the traditional type of fundraising. Now, testing whether that works for other people and whether this was just a Bernie phenomenon or whether that can be reliably, you know, brought into action for other people with other causes is the great unknown at this point.
How about Amy's?
I don't think he's been marginalized. I think he's a very, very powerful voice.
And Senator, how about Amy's other point, which is that, hey, Democrats do it too, meaning they take big corporate dollars as well?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, in this last election, we caught up a lot, like my remark about my Republican colleague. Because so much of the big money didn't like Trump initially, once he became inevitable, the money flooded in. But initially, they didn't like him much. And Hillary, I think, was seen as the go-to likely winner, so people wanted to get behind her. So she was able to do very well with big money fundraising and even to pull some new fundraising stunts that had not been thought of before. But if you take a look at an issue like climate change, you see the fossil fuel industry lined up essentially targeting all its firepower, all of its Citizens United artillery against Republicans right now in order to force conformity in the Republican Party. And by doing so, they've created it as a very clear example of a divide between Democrats and Republicans. My experience, Steve, is that divide isn't real. When I got here to the Senate, there were five or six Republicans all working on climate bills. But then came Citizens United. Then came this new artillery to the fossil fuel industry. And they basically said to Republicans, hey, if you're going to mess with us, you're going to be severely disadvantaged. You're going to be in political peril. Do not do this. And the result has been a complete cessation of any bipartisan activity any longer. And that's been a heartbreaker for people like me who care a lot
about
this.
A lot of people are going to listen to that and think that's just chilling, Senator, what you just said.
Chilling is, I think, a pretty fair description.
Yeah. Let's go back to some more phone calls here for Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Terry from Independence, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I would just like to share what I think is a good example of legislation that's been suppressed by corporate funds, and that's a single-payer health care system such as H.R. 676 would provide. H.R. 676 has been around since about 2003 and has been introduced at every session of Congress since then, but has never made it out of committee. It's a single-payer health care system which would provide health care for everyone.
Right.
No one would be excluded, and our taxes to support that would be less than what we're paying now in premiums, much less what we're paying in co-pays and deductibles.
Yeah, Terry, let me get a response. I just had the senator for a couple more minutes. Senator, do you agree with Terry?
I absolutely do. And it's not so much that the bill didn't pass. It's that the bill, which is a significant bill, never made it out of committee and has never been a part of a real, genuine conversation, in the same way that there is no genuine conversation in Washington now about pharmaceutical pricing limits. And there's no genuine conversation about doing anything about climate change. There are big issues that people care a lot about, and there is no real conversation about them because the very, very powerful interests can more or less kill the conversation in its crib.
I'm going to grab one more call just quickly. Nick, just give me 20 seconds if you would. Nick from Parkville.
Yes, I'm worried we're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater by having such screes against corporate America. Corporate America represents ordinarily thousands of investors and tens of thousands of employees, and obviously they should be able to put forward their views to our legislators. If you want to reduce the degree of lobbying, okay, let's regulate it. But this scree against the most effective way of financing lasers and medical advances and everything else is just misplaced.
Senator, I got just 10 seconds or so.
Let me respond to that, because I'm very clear about this in the book. Corporations, I say in the book, are perhaps the most economically advantageous thing that has been designed since the wheel. We have been made a healthier and wealthier society as a result of corporations. It is an incredibly efficient way to organize capital and focus loyalty to the task of making money for shareholders and making products for people. Where it does not belong is in our elections.
Okay.
I'm more than happy to have people listen to corporations, but they should not be able to buy our elections. The founding fathers had no idea that this was going to happen, and it has just deformed our government.
I'm sorry I couldn't get to all our callers, but I want to thank Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Again, his new book, Captured, The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. Senator, you filled up our boards with callers. I sure appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be on.
All the best. Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk with two Kansas City stars of sci-fi storytelling. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the program, I asked the ethics professors about the moral obligations of a government and about the principles of digitally resurrecting dead entertainers. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, we're live from the Nelson Atkins. We'll get a sneak peek at the new block galleries. You can join us for that. Now let's turn to a conversation I had a couple weeks ago with two sci-fi storytellers at the top of their game, and they both call Kansas City home. Sci-fi and comic books used to be an obscure corner of the storytelling market, reserved for, politely speaking, a niche audience. But blockbuster hits like The Dark Knight and Marvel's Avengers have driven the genre to mainstream status. Iconic actors like Robert Downey Jr. and Scarlett Johansson often contribute to their success, but it's the work behind the scenes that makes the genre unique. Today we take a look at a few storytellers who make the comics and movies possible. With us this morning, Jason Aaron is a comic book writer known for his work on titles such as Thor, Doctor Strange, and Wolverine. And Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
Bruce Brannett is also here. He's a filmmaker and special effects artist behind Visual Scene in Star Trek and AMC's Breaking Bad. And Bruce, nice to have you too.
Welcome. How you doing?
Well, Bruce, you were raised in Kansas City and even attended KU for a time before moving out to L.A. What brought you and your business back here?
Well, I met my wife in Los Angeles, and I was happily working in visual effects, like you mentioned, on shows like Star Trek. And we kind of wanted to raise kids, and we didn't want to do it in Los Angeles.
Why not?
You know, I always think that in here in Kansas City, you see kids walking to school, and I always thought in Los Angeles there must be some underground tunnel because you never see them anywhere. It's just, it's a better place. I grew up here and I wanted that for my family too, and I found out that I could do the work remotely.
So many folks say that about Kansas City, and you're embodying all of that then, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Isn't the West Coast, though, where it's all happening for guys like you?
Somewhat. My business, I have two businesses, kind of. One is doing visual effects for existing products like Westworld I've worked on, and I work on The Flash right now. Mm-hmm. And I can do that remotely through Google Fiber. But my other business is one that's more creative generation. I'm pitching and I'm writing and I'm producing my own projects to try and get made into movies. It's a little harder to do here. You have to have a little bit more of a foothold in Los Angeles to be available for a meeting in 3 hours.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
But without Google Fiber, you might have problems.
Yeah, well, I moved back here before Google Fiber.
Ah.
And, you know, it's just you have to work ahead. You have to know when problems are coming before they happen.
Yeah.
To be able to send stuff to Los Angeles overnight rather than in the next 20 minutes.
Well, Jason, you also moved to Kansas City. Is that just a coincidence, or is there something about the industry that's happening here?
Well, I mean, at the time, I didn't really know anything about the comics industry here. I kind of moved because a family member had moved here, and after college, I just kind of wanted to go somewhere. But it was only once I moved here and found out how many comic creators there were who live and work in Kansas City that I was able to kind of first break into comics.
And what's the job market here when it comes to what you do in the Kansas City area? What have you found?
There are a lot of people, writers and artists, who live in Kansas City and work for pretty much every comic book company you can think of, Marvel, DC, Image, you know, kind of all the major companies, for whatever reason. I don't know, you know, some of them are from here, some people move from other places, but this has kind of become a nice little conglomeration of comic creators here in Kansas City.
How okay is Marvel with the fact that you're out here in Kansas City? Do they care?
No, I mean, that's the great thing about working in comics these days. I mean, when I was a kid trying to break in, you know, this is what I've wanted to do since I was in fifth grade, but I had no idea how to do it growing up. And back then, you pretty much had to live in New York, which is, you know, where the publishing part of Marvel is concentrated. These days, it doesn't matter. I mean, right now I have six books, six different series coming out. And the creators who work on those series, you got guys who live on the East Coast, the West Coast. You got people who live in France and Spain and Italy, England. So, I've done books where just within one creative team, you've got three or four different countries represented. So it doesn't matter anymore where you're from. If anything, it's better to have a different voice, to be from somewhere unusual, somewhere different. So you get a lot of different voices in the mix.
And Bruce, as Jason is talking, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, on the visual effects side, I've found that as well. I've worked with a modeler, an animator that's in Florida who I've never met in person.
Really?
And
it works okay.
It works okay. And a lot of my career as well is I've worked on all the Star Trek series, so most of the supervisors and producers I know well. So when I moved here, they've moved on to other shows. I got work on those shows. I got to meet other producers on those shows remotely. So the supervisor I worked with on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, I didn't know from when I lived in Los Angeles. It's a new relationship built on me not screwing anything up.
Yeah. Jason, I'm just curious. You said that you were interested in comic books from the time you were in fifth grade going forward. What was it that captured your imagination to the extent that it did? Comic books, I get it. You
sure.
Know.
I mean, I've still got the specific issues that kind of made me a fan.
What was it?
One of the first ones was the issue of World's Finest, which is a DC anthology book. It would have stories about Superman, Batman, Hawkman, Green Arrow, lots of different characters. So the idea that there was this whole universe of characters, some of whom I'd never heard of, that pulled me in. And then there's a great Neil Adams cover of Batman turning into a bat. I don't know. I mean, it was mostly DC stuff as a kid that pulled me in, lots of superhero stuff. And it was a good time to be a comic book fan, kind of growing up in the 80s. Comic books got a little more darker and serious, and you got different genres, different companies popping up. So it was a lot more than just superhero books. So
when did you think you could do that work, that you had the talent it took to do what you do?
Well, I mean, I wanted to do it, from when I was a kid. I remember telling my dad, that's what I'm going to do when I grow up, even though I had no idea how to go about doing that, and took me till I was almost 30 years old before I was actually able to kind of get my foot in the door. So it took me a long time. I mean, I always felt kind of growing up, going through college, I knew I wanted to write. I always felt like being a good enough writer is the hard part. If I could just do that, the breaking in thing, I can figure that out. People do that all the time. It's being good enough that you actually warrant somebody paying money to read what you wrote. That's what I always strive for.
Yeah. We're talking, if you're just joining us on Up to Date this morning, about sci-fi and comic books and the industry here in Kansas City. You know, Bruce, I know you're asked this all the time. You've been nominated for 6 Emmy Awards, one of which was for your work on Breaking Bad, that hugely successful show. You worked on a few of the episodes. Tell us about that set. Tell us about that show. We had Bryan Cranston on just a few months ago. I want to ask you about that, too.
It's an amazing show. It's one that, everybody on it is just the coolest person you'd want to meet.
At the
Emmy Awards, I talked with Vince Gilligan, and he was more interested in what I did than my interest in, his brain. And it's like, how is such a wonderful, nice person write things that are so twisted and interesting and deep?
It was really twisted and interesting and deep, wasn't it?
It was great.
Just phenomenally so.
Yeah, it was great. And that the shot on that was the famous shot at the end of season 5 we did. I won't go into spoilers with Gus, but the episode was called Face Off. It was kind of the first moment that I'd been involved on the effects side in something that became like a popular culture moment where it was like the next day everyone in the country was talking about that shot.
Can you describe it a little more to us?
Well, a character meets his demise, yet still kind of puts on airs because the character was based on appearing to be a normal person. And when the monster underneath him was literally exposed to the skull, he still straightens his tie before he dies. And that was a shot that was like, it was great to work on. It was great to be involved in how are we going to do this long before they shot it. Mm-hmm. And then to see it all the way through and see it get to the air with, us, with nobody knowing what was coming. Even the actors weren't allowed to see it when they came back in to do ADR, additional dialogue recording.
Really?
What's the shot?
Really?
Yeah.
And what was their reaction when they saw it?
Everybody loved it. Everybody mm-hmm. loved it. It was perfect.
Mm-hmm. And you were responsible for the entire take there?
We did the visual effects on the shot. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there was a whole crew involved. They did, I think, something like 27 takes and used take 27. Wow. It's a long, extended shot of a reveal of a character. And just a lot of hard work and passion on every level went into that.
At what point did you get involved with Breaking Bad? Was it already a hit by the time you came aboard, or was it early on?
Yeah, it was about season 3 we started doing some work on that show, mm-hmm. yeah.
That's got to be a kick when a show you know is working and working well, and you get to have a piece of it.
It's great. It takes a little bit away. Like, I worked on Lost, was one of the shows I worked on that I was a huge fan of, and that was a bit of a problem because, you know, you get calls like, we need to bid a shot of the island disappearing. It's like, well, that's going to happen now. That's a little bit of a spoiler.
It takes it away for you?
A little bit. I mean, I wouldn't trade it to mm-hmm. being just a fan, but being a fan and working on the show helps because you can go deeper and ask the questions like, you know, what is the smoke monster? You know, it would help if I understood this to be part of your storyteller, because my job as a visual effects artist is to tell part of someone else's story within a 3 to 7 second shot.
Hmm. Were you a fan of Breaking Bad when you went to work on that set?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, that's got to be kind of weird if you're a fan and then you're going to work and you're seeing the underbelly of the beast, and it's got to be a completely different thing.
A bit. It's a little, I mean, working on Star Trek was kind of the same way, where you're like, oh, this is the bridge. Well, it doesn't quite look as great in person, but okay.
We'll make it work then, right? We had, as I mentioned, Bryan Cranston on the show a few months ago, and he mentioned that he felt it was just pure luck that brought him to Breaking Bad to begin with. And your story there was what?
About how I came to Breaking Bad?
Yes.
Well, the supervisor on that show I worked with on Pushing Daisies. Mm-hmm. And he went on to that show. And that's actually the person I was talking about earlier that I didn't know when I lived in Los Angeles. But on Pushing Daisies, he worked with a coordinator who had worked on Star Trek Enterprise and X-Files and worked with me. And some things came up on Pushing Daisies. She's like, well, why don't we call Bruce? So that's what started that relationship. And we carried that over into Breaking Bad. And now some work on Better Call Saul.
And that's how Hollywood works on so many levels, I gather. Just relationships, you bounce from show to show, and your list of contacts grows very quickly.
It's all about the people you know, but like Aaron said, you have to be good at the work too.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not good at it, it doesn't matter who you know. So as long as you have the base of, you know, a quality, good eye, and you're capable of doing the work, the relationships are what moves that forward.
You know, we're on radio, obviously, and it's hard to describe, perhaps, but what would people say that you're especially good at, Bruce? What do you bring to special effects that maybe listeners could relate to a little bit?
Well, I don't know. I would say that, you know, my specialty is understanding how to use and not use a visual effect in order just to tell the story. You don't want the visual effect to overpower the story. Breaking Bad hates CGI. They really don't want to do visual effects, and I agree with them on that if you can get it in camera, you should, because the danger of using visual effects is that a shot will come off as false. It'll mm-hmm. pull someone out of the story and make them wonder about the effect rather than just being invested in the story. And my specialty, I think, is understanding the visual effect coming from a storyteller standpoint rather than knowing what buttons to push or what color a Ferengi phaser might be.
That's interesting to me, because when I think of Breaking Bad and I knew you were coming on the show, I was thinking, well, what special effects were on Breaking Bad?
A shot where Walter runs down a couple drug dealers in his Pontiac Aztec, which was entirely CGI,
mm-hmm.
which nobody knew at the time.
And CGI stands for?
Computer graphical image.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jason, you've had your share of success as well. You've received a handful of writing awards and a number of nominations, but competing is nothing new to you. Tell us how you got started writing comics and the search contest that you were involved in once upon a time.
Right. Yeah. You know, like I said, I wanted to write comics since I was a kid. I had no idea how to really go about breaking into comics. And then in the summer of 2000, Marvel Comics did a talent search contest, which was something they had never done before and they haven't done since. So it was, you know, a very rare opportunity. So I entered that. I just, you know, typed up a one-page synopsis of a Wolverine story idea and dropped it on a big pile of them at a convention in Chicago and
no
kind of forgot about it. And it was Well, I remember thinking at one point, asked one of my friends, like, whatever happened with that contest? And he was like, well, I think they announced the winner of it. So I was like, oh, well, I guess I didn't win. And then I was at work one day and had a message on my phone from an editor at Marvel asking me to call him back. And my first thought was like, wow, that's really cruel of him just to call to tell me I didn't win. but I did win, and, you know, I got to do just an 8-page Wolverine story was my first published work. And, you know, at the time I thought, you know, this was it, like next stop comic book superstardom. And it was five years later before I had my next book coming out. So it's probably the 5 years I've worked the hardest of all the time I've been in comics, because I was writing and pitching that entire time and working on what would eventually be my next book. But it was, you know, 5 years of waiting and working.
It was the 5-year delay was because why? Because the book wasn't going to get published for 5 years, or what was it?
No, well, it was just trying to find that next job. And then even once I got it, kind of working on that next job and waiting for it to come together. So there was a lot of hurry up and wait. But kind of once that the next book started coming out, I did a Vietnam War book for DC Vertigo. It was kind of my first full 22-page comic that I had published. But that, you know, led to the next thing. And the next thing was a book called Scalped, which ran for 60 issues. And, you know, that kind of led me back to Marvel. And I've been there ever since.
But winning that contest, it sounds like, was an important moment.
Yeah, I mean, like we were talking about earlier about feeling like you're, you know, I can actually do this. That was the moment when I was like, okay, like a professional editor actually picked my story out of a, you know, out of a pile of other entries. So maybe I'm actually good enough where I can take a stab at this.
I mean, you just don't hear of that happening very often. I mean, it certainly speaks to your talent, but what a break to come out, to emerge out of a pile and win something like that.
Well, you know, I think any industry like this where it's hard to break in, you know, you have to get lucky in some sense. I think you also have to make your own luck.
Persistence and just staying with it and believing in yourself, all those things apply
exactly.
Here.
You know, again, those 5 years when I was emailing editors and working on stuff, I had to be very persistent, but also polite. So, you know, there's a line between being persistent and being a pain in the neck. But yeah, I think all those years I spent writing, just wanting to get better as a writer, ultimately when that opportunity presented itself, I was able to jump on it.
Just in a sentence or two, what was the plot of the story you submitted that won? I mean,
Wolverine.
Yeah.
Well, it was, I was told mine stood out because it was one of the only ones that didn't take place in a bar or involve ninjas. Mine was kind of a play on a Flannery O'Connor story, A Good Man is Hard to Find. So it was Wolverine meeting this old woman in the woods who's got a flat tire, and he's helping her change her tire, and they're talking about faith and God, and of course things go south by the end of it, but
worked.
That was it. So Wolverine and Flannery O'Connor gave me a comic book career.
You know, Marvel Comics recently made the move to a female protagonist in Thor, and you, Jason, were one of the minds behind that. Why make that change? That's a big step.
Well, I mean, it was that was something that grew out of the story I was already telling. I've been on Thor for, I think, 4 years now. And we were always dealing with the idea of worthiness. You know, Thor has to be worthy to pick up his hammer. And what does that really mean? And what does it mean to be a god in the Marvel Universe? So we were always kind of playing with those ideas. And I knew at some point he would go to pick up that hammer and not be able to. And that puts him off on one particular story and opens the door for someone else to come along and pick that up. And at first it was a mystery as to who that the new female Thor was, and we eventually found out it was, you know, Thor's longtime girlfriend, Jane Foster, who's not just Thor, but is also, in her human form, is dealing with breast cancer. So the act of picking up that hammer is actually neutralizing her chemotherapy and killing her a little more every time she does it. So that's sort of the journey she's been on. But it was not Marvel coming to me saying, you have to do this. It was me saying, this is what I want to do.
Did someone have to sign off? Editors have to think about this a bit? Or?
Yeah. We have retreats a couple times a year where we all go sit in New York and talk about, you know, what we're going to be doing.
Are those fun?
Yeah. Well, it's a little like a job, and it's like 9 to 5. You're sitting in a room talking about comic books.
Yeah.
But It's better than any other job I ever had.
You know, a lot of movies are being made these days about comic book characters, and they've made big bucks at the box office. Is this just a trend, or do the two of you think that's going to succeed and continue?
Hard to say. I mean, I know that I'm not really in the comic book genre, but
right.
I mean, what I understand is the phase. What is it? Which phase are we on with Marvel? With Infinity War, I mean, the idea is that's kind of narratively wrapping something up. But on the broader sense, I find it fascinating that, you know, these stories that are fantastical or science fiction have moved into, you know, not just kids' movies, but everybody's
mainstream
movies.
Do you ever work on those kinds of movies?
Not really. I do a little bit of visual effects work on The Flash, as I said. That's mm-hmm. the other guys on the DC side, but... all of that is really just kind of mechanical stuff. It's nothing that I would call deep story important type of input.
Jason, what's your sense of the future of comic book movies?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of I'm just over in the publishing wing. I like the Marvel films, especially. My kid and I love going to see them. You know, it's cool when I've seen little bits of stuff I've done pop up in them. But I mean, I love doing the comics. I mean, the great thing about comics is that we don't have to worry about what our special effects budget is. You know, mm-hmm. like it's whatever I can get this person to draw.
Mm-hmm.
So it's limitless. And I get to work with some of the most amazing artists, you know, literally from all over the world. So I'm very, very happy doing that. And then I'll sit back like everybody else and watch what they do with it. At Marvel Entertainment, Studios.
At the end of the day, when you boil it down, I mean, sci-fi storytelling, it's just storytelling, right? I mean, what's the most important aspect of that process?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it is about just telling a good story. It doesn't matter kind of what the genre trappings are. And superhero stories, you know, whether I'm writing about Wolverine or I'm writing about Thor, who's a literally a god, or I'm writing about aliens or whatever, there's got to be something relatable. You know, there's got to mm-hmm. be a piece of me in it. There's got to be something that whoever's reading it responds to. It can't just be people in funny costumes punching each other over and over again.
A piece of me. Give me an example of a piece of you that you've stuck in one of your scripts, one of your stories.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to tell you that. I mean, again, I'm more comfortable doing the thing than I am mm-hmm. talking about the thing. But
right.
yeah, there are moments of dialogue from my life or things I've been through, and some things, you know, I don't talk about or wouldn't talk about. But again, or sometimes it's just fun stuff. You know, I think, one example is when I wrote Wolverine for about 6 years. You know, that's how I won the talent search contest. I wrote a lot of Wolverine stories of Wolverine stabbing people with claws, right? That's what mm-hmm. he does. Then over the course of that, as my career was building, I became a dad for the first time. So I started doing a very different Wolverine story that was him running the school. So it kind of became Wolverine as a father figure. So
that's
that was very much a reflection of what I was going through.
Does the same apply to the work that you do,
I mean,
Bruce, in the special effects idea?
I mean, in addition to special effects, I mean, that's a subset of my larger career and ambitions as a writer and a director. And so my stories, I found, tend to deal with technology and how that kind of tends to separate us
mm-hmm.
and leaving us wanting to connect face to face more so as humans. And, you know, I find that in there. I've gone through becoming a father as well and find out that my short films and things that I'm writing and pitching tend to kind of deal with those issues of, you know, how do you deal with the technology that we're just being hit with from every angle.
Yeah, just quickly, what advice would the two of you give for someone listening who wants to follow in your footsteps and get into the work that you do in special, you know, effects, Bruce, or comic book writing, Jason? How do they do it?
I mean, I think if you want to write comics, then the important thing is, you know, devour stories, read voraciously, and then create stories however you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just make stuff. Yeah, continue to make stuff. I mean, there's a fire hose of entertainment out there, but, you know, you've got to get in that stream and keep swimming and keep making stuff. You can't just think about it.
And get to know people, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, that's Jason Aaron. He's a comic book writer known for his work on titles such as Thor, Doctor Strange, and Wolverine. Bruce Brannett is a filmmaker and special effects artist behind a visual scene in Star Trek and Breaking Bad. Gentlemen, thanks very much for the conversation. It's really good to have you
here.
Thanks, Ed. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday's show, we're live from the Nelson Atkins. Join us as we celebrate the opening of the new block galleries. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.